Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Matt Lieb.
And I'm Vince Mancini.
And this is Pod Yourself the Wire.
The Wire.
A The Wire podcast where Vince Mancini and I go through every single episode of The Wire
and talk about it.
Thank you once again for listening to the world's only The Wire podcast, The Wire, a show about hating your boss. And other things. Just a reminder, 5 stars and a review on the Apple iPodcast store. I don't know what it's called anymore. It's like called podcasts, I think. And also, once again, we have a Reddit that was created by a listener named Tanglefisk. So you can go to our Pod Yourself, The Wire, and, you know, talk about it. I like when people go on the internet and talk about, you know, The Wire.
Yeah, your ears start burning. Like, yeah, oh, that's like, me.
The Wire, we made that.
Yeah.
That's us. Yeah, so go ahead and do that for me and for yourself. Because you know what? It's a lot of fun. Isn't that right, Vince?
That's right.
I don't believe you. today we're going to be talking about from season 3 of The Wire, episode 2, All Due Respect. And our guest today, oh boy, ladies and gentlemen and everyone else, you know this guy from the wonderful History of Rome podcast, as well as Revolutions, and soon coming up, the Duncan and Co. History Show. Ladies and gentlemen, Mike Duncan is here.
Mike Duncan is in fact here. Yes.
Hell yeah. Yeah. There we go.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Where's the applause?
I got a soundboard. I got all sorts of shit I can do.
Great.
Yeah. See, this is, you know, I listen to Revolutions and I've always noticed that like the big problem I've had with it is so many moments where you could do a reggae horn.
Mm. Yeah.
And
exactly.
And you just, you know, you left it out.
I kept waiting for the right moment and it just never showed up, which is why there's no sound effects and no music and no anything in Revolutions or the History of Rome. It's just one guy talking in a monotone voice about
political
history.
Yeah. Which I will admit completely that I love the show. And I also, and I don't know if you've heard this before. I'm sure you have. I fall asleep to it sometimes, not saying
sure.
That.
Oh, no, no, no. I take that as a compliment.
Yeah. It's like this thing where it's like, I've listened to the show multiple times. And then at some point I realized that like, oh, this is kind of like good to fall asleep to as well. Yeah. Not like in a way where it's like, oh, it's boring. No, it's just that you have a soothing voice. Whereas
yeah, and
like,
and the content is just interesting enough that you don't tune it out, but then
right.
It's also soothing enough that it kind of just takes you away to slumberland.
Yeah, yeah, it's very soothing content, you know, with the beheadings and whatnot.
Right, and exactly.
I love a good, you know, I love a good war, a World War I type war that just goes on and on. I love the, you know, all the massacres, the many massacres that happen on Sundays and other
but
days.
But I tell it to you like a lullaby.
You do. Yeah. You yeah. almost sing it. It's like with yeah. a nice little Irish lilt. Mm-hmm. But
I have that argument with my wife a lot where she likes to fall asleep to things with like a laugh track that, you know, like old sitcoms and stuff. And I need like a good true crime about like murder or a history podcast about beheadings to really like take my brain away from my reality. And
I've been falling asleep lately to like the old like BBC Poirot series.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
Which is just that. It's like it's all just very chill. You know, you know, like there's like a chase scene, but it's like nobody's going more than 15 miles an hour. It's just like utterly
right. They're on bikes.
And charming. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And,
like, there's nothing more soothing.
I know who did it. So I'm just kind of going through the motions of like watching this little Belgian guy be kind of adorable.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And also, you know, that accent, it's a sleepy time accent.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
That's the type of guy you want to talk you to sleep. But yeah, so The Wire, let's talk about it. You're here. You watch The Wire. And from what I remember, this is a recent thing. You just recently completed The Wire. Is that right?
Yes, this is a very recent. It was a long overdue development that then developed and is now in the past, where I was kind of like the show came out at a time when I don't remember exactly why it was that I wasn't watching. I obviously like didn't have HBO.
But then it
started going down. It's like, this is maybe the greatest TV series of all time. And so I had to, you know, if I'm going to do it, I really want to make sure that I have time to commit to it. And then like I had kids and other things started happening, and it just kind of getting put off and put off. And so last summer I finally sat down and, you know, the family left for a week and I was home alone, and I was like, I'm just going to sit down and do The Wire.
It's Wire time
to finish, and I'm going to
do it. You won them back. It only took you 7 days. That's impressive.
Yeah. Well, once they knew that I finished The Wire, they were like, okay, yeah, we'll come back.
Okay. Now we have something to talk about.
You were losing us before. Yeah.
Idea that they left because you were starting The Wire.
Yeah.
Daddy needs time alone with McNulty.
Because I hadn't watched. Well, I didn't know that I needed home time alone with McNulty. But apparently I did. And so, yeah, I mean, I concur with what everybody always said. But like I watched The Shield when it was live. Like I was watching those as new episodes. And I watched The Sopranos when those were new episodes. And so I kind of, and I was a huge fan of Homicide, Life on the Streets. Right. Like I was watching those in the 90s when that was actually like, you know, if you would ask me what's your favorite drama, like in some like junior high or high school class, I would have been like, oh, yeah, Homicide, Life on the Streets is the one. So it was always kind of surprising to even to me that I had never just sat down and knocked it out. But I finally did. And I have now seen all of the episodes one time,
nice.
Except for this episode, which I have now seen 2 times.
Hell yeah.
So that's where I'm at in my Wire knowledge.
In sixth grade, you were like, Homicide, this is clearly like the most realistic show that's about the real streets.
Yeah. I don't know how many conversations were had, but I wasn't saying like, you know, like I'm a slasher flick guy, but like, you know, Adrian, how do you pronounce his last name? Adrian Brano.
That sounds right.
Yeah. He's a magnetic human being.
Oh, he's great.
Yeah.
Tour de force.
No. I do like the idea that in sixth grade you were trying to talk about Homicide and other people were like, I like Urkel.
Yeah. Urkel.
Because he's always eating cheese.
Yeah. and giving the cop from Die Hard a bad time.
That's right. That's right. That guy is
I do like to think that that's like in universe and that guy like retired.
Carl Winslow is a Baltimore PD.
That Carl like kind of like.
He walked away
from Die Hard and was like, I'm going to go hang out someplace normal like Baltimore.
Oh, was he a cop on the show? I feel like he was a cop.
On, yeah,
he
was a cop.
Yeah, he's like, he was like the Michael Pena where he always plays a cop.
He just has kind of like cop vibe. He has 90s cop vibes.
Yeah.
Like, which was like, you know, pudgy cop with donut type
Yeah, friendly, but also like his redemption arc in Die Hard is that he's like willing to kill again.
Right.
I mean, that's the whole thing. Yeah. In Die Hard, he's like, I don't know if I can be a cop because I won't just blow people away. But at the end of Die Hard, he blew some guy away. And he's like,
you got to get back on the horse.
You know,
you got to get back on the horse.
My character arc has been resolved here. I can murder again. Great.
That is a spinoff. You know what? That's a spinoff I would love to see. And if David Simon, if you're out there listening to this, which I'm sure you are.
Yeah.
How about a The Wire spinoff starring Carl Winslow? / the diehard cop.
Yeah.
So you liked The Wire, I assume, when you watched it.
I did like The Wire. Yeah, it's very good.
Do you have a favorite season?
This third season might be it. Like, might be the one. Just because I also like, I like Colvin a lot. Like, I think he's also in that same kind of category. It's just like anytime he's on screen. I remember even when he was shown up as like a guest star, probably in like the second season. He was he was there, but he was just kind of like generic, you know, like brass.
Right.
Like at a crime scene. But you could just like when he showed up, you're just like, I don't know who that guy is. But I like him.
I want more of that guy.
Yeah, I want more of that guy. And then season three, they were just like, here's a bunch of that guy kind of just like being the most of that guy that he could possibly be. And so, like when I think about it, I think the third season is probably the one that honestly gets me the most.
Nice.
So I was happy
to
talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad to have you on for the third season. Do you have a favorite character?
Well, I mean, we're at a point right now where we're like, you know, everybody's seen this show, so we're not like pretending people don't know what it is.
Right.
Okay, so I can speak. So it's Bodhi, I think, gets me.
Oh, yes.
You know, and Bodhi is the one who, you know, he comes into it pretty ruthlessly. So it is important to remember that Bodhi is not like none of these people are good people, right? Like this is
right. One of
the things we always have to remember. But Bodhi is the one who I sort of my heart goes out to the most.
Totally.
And when he got it, I was like, God, you know,
yeah.
That one hurt. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Him getting clipped was one that was emotional.
He went out like a man, though, you know,
he stood his ground on his corner
and he died the way he wanted to die.
Cause it was bullshit, man. He got sold out by everybody. And
he did.
You know, he played the game exactly the way he was told to play the game. And for his troubles was, you know, murdered as they are.
Yeah. No, I'm a big Bodhi head as well. I think Bodhi is like one of those characters. When you say like, you know, he's not a good guy, it's like, yeah, there are no real good guys, bad guys on the show. There's no one who's like pure of intentions, and there's no one who doesn't have dirt on their hands. And Bodhi was the one, I think, who most humanized that kind of like the corner boy, like the one who would be easily the like villain on any other show.
Yeah.
Just like, oh, this is bad, man. But he wasn't. He was just a product of his environment.
Because he's a henchman, you know. Like
yeah.
he never really rises above like senior henchman.
Yeah,
where he's in charge of the force.
He's a violence proponent. You know, he's not really conflicted about that part of it.
But at the same time, like he's just so you know, kind of correctly frustrated all the time with the way everything is being handled. You know, and even in this episode, right, when Stringer Bell is like, you know, why didn't you find Marlo? And he's like, well, because you called this meeting, man. Like, I'm here for the meeting that you called me to. And he's like, fuck you, get out of here. You know, Bodhi's just like, God, man, the only reason I'm here is because you told me to be here.
Exactly.
So him kind of harumphing his way around Baltimore is very good television.
Trying to find Marlo so that he can do this cockamamie plan that Stringer has about like, what if we franchise this shit and turn it into McDonald's and less like a drug operation, which Bodhi knows, not because he took any class, but because he's just been around. He's like, this is not going to work and it's going to end really badly.
Not only
everyone.
Is it not going to work, it's like asking, you know, it's like asking the writers that are going to be replaced by AI to like go tell the, you know, like to
train the AI.
And it's like, why would he like this plan? He's the franchisee. Like, he's the muscle that you need on the corner. Why would he want a plan that involves less muscle out on the streets? Like, that's literally his job.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, we cannot get into all of this stuff without first starting the podcast, and we cannot start it without first playing the theme song. Pod. Podcast. The Irish Pod. Season 3. All right, ladies and gentlemen and everyone else, today, once again, we're going to be talking about from Season 3 of The Wire, Episode 2, All Due Respect. This episode premiered on September 26, 2004. Vince, can you break us off a little piece of that synopsis?
I would love to read this official synopsis that Matt definitely didn't write.
Yep.
Herc details how much gay sex he would have in order to have straight sex. Also, other things happen.
That's right. That's the episode. And thank you, IMDb, for writing it. But Vince, what was happening at the time that this episode came out?
Yeah, that's right, Matt. I think what you're trying to say is that we cannot evaluate culture or divorce from its cultural... We cannot evaluate art divorced from its cultural context. Therefore, we have to put some of that context back in with a little something we like to call the back-in-the-day machine.
It's a bad time for newspapers. The news hole is shrinking as advertising dollars continue to decline.
There ain't no back in the day.
Machine tells the tale, son.
All right. And today we're going all the way back to September 26, 2004. Some of the things that were happening were Kerry makes Iraq his number one attack. Drop in polls.
John Kerry?
John Kerry. That's right. Drop in polls against Bush leads to change in strategy.
I'm going to do more Iraq violence. That'll work.
Just a few weeks ago, Senator John Kerry's aides were saying the home stretch of his bid to oust President Bush would focus on the economy, health care, and other domestic issues. Now, almost overnight, Kerry has made Iraq his dominant campaign cause. Day by day last week, his attacks on Bush's handling of Iraq grew more caustic. The invasion of Iraq was a profound diversion from the battle against our greatest enemy, Al-Qaeda, which killed more than 3,000 people on 9/11 and which still plots our destruction today, Kerry said Friday at Temple University in Philadelphia.
Not wrong. Not wrong.
Sure.
And there's just no question about it. The president's misjudgment, miscalculation, and mismanagement of the war in Iraq all make the war on terror harder to win.
Oh, I'm also very excited for this butt that's coming up.
No, there's no butt, man.
He's you know, Kerry's campaign was about laying into Bush for the Iraq war and everything that went wrong with it, and Kerry was supposed to be beyond reproach on this issue, like, because he had this war record, and so he was going to be the only one who was able to, like, credibly make these critiques of Bush. But of course, none of that matters because they just swift boated the hell out of it. And yeah,
that's right.
Other things. This one is from a British newspaper. Headline, revenge.com, how the internet fuels the battle of the exes. See if you can figure out where this one is going.
Oh, yeah. Dishing this is about revenge porn, isn't it?
Dishing the dirt with a strange emphasis. Dishing the dirt on former lovers used to be for celebrities only, but now we're all telling the world via the web. Famous people do it in the press, but the rest of us always had to seek revenge on errant lovers in the courts or by cutting up their clothes. Not anymore.
Who wrote this?
That seems to be really assuming, like, if you're like me and you put your shoes on every morning and then go and, like, declare war on your exes and try to destroy their lives.
It's not just for celebrities anymore.
We didn't have the internet. You know, we had to do it the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, I had to go door knocking and showing Polaroids to people just to, like, get back at my exes.
Look at my whore wife. Yeah, and be like, call the cops, please.
I don't identify with the writer of that article.
It's written by someone named Katie Guest. Not anymore. The internet is providing the perfect means for ordinary men and women to strike back at their exes.
It just sounds it's like a startup. This is like a disruption in the revenge porn market.
Several websites have been set up to exploit the taste for vengeance, the latest of which is the newly launched myexwifeisabitch.com.
Are you kidding me? Is this man? Oh, my God.
Why is this?
Demonic, resentful, and spiteful is how one man describes his former partner during a lengthy rant about access to their daughter. Who is named?
Thought they were describing the website, but of course, no.
The website sounds like it's those things maybe more than that guy's ex-wife is.
100% more.
Most revenge sites are for women. But myexwifeisabitch.com has been set up for men by Dave Schofield and Brian Sibbald from Bristol.
Great.
I went through a divorce and it ended up costing me over £20,000, says Mr. Schofield. You end up financially stuffed, and the worst thing is you are forced by law and by an angry ex-partner not to see your daughter.
So it's only fair that I'll get to post nudes of a Bobby's.
For a fee of £25, members tell their own stories and look for friends in similar positions.
Oh, this is now getting... This is sad.
It's not anti-women, the site insists, although many women may disagree.
No, it's not. Okay. It's not.
Excuse me. What's the name of the website again? Say the name of the website again.
Myexwifeisabitch.com.
It's not anti-women.
I don't know how you could get that idea. Yeah. I mean, if you're taking the website name out of context here. Oh my God, this is
all right. So we're doing 30 seconds on one of the most consequential presidential elections of our lifetime that was happening right as this episode was dropping, We have now done 5 minutes on my ex-wife is a bitch.com.
That's where we're at.
Yeah. Listen, the thing about this show is we have to add the cultural context. And I think this cultural context is much more important than
it feels like a longer time ago than the Bush Kerry debate to me in some ways.
You mean people paying to do
just everything, like all the technology
that it would be newsworthy that you could use the internet to get back to your exes.
Right.
Which I'm sure was happening like on bulletin boards in the 80s.
100%. It was happening on LiveJournal a few years earlier.
The idea that the guys who run my ex-wife's a bitch.com would be celebrated as disruptors and like savvy technologists in the newspaper. Yeah. It's very good.
Yeah.
On that note, music sites ask, why buy if you can rent? Today, Sir Richard Branson.
But they got their answer real fast on that one. But go ahead.
Yeah. Today, Sir Richard Branson starts a new music store, virgindigital.com, this time selling music as streams of bits to be downloaded from the internet. Virgin, a unit of the Virgin Group, becomes the first major music retailer to enter the download market, which has been dominated by Apple Computer and other technology companies. What's interesting is that Virgin is putting its biggest emphasis on its subscription service rather than on selling songs one at a time for 99 cents a track, as Apple and Microsoft do. It is betting that new customers will join its Virgin Music Club for $7.99 monthly fee to listen to an unlimited amount of music from Virgin's 1 million track library.
Oh, that's actually...
This is what it became.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's a premium music subscription service that will allow those tracks to be moved to a portable music player for a slightly higher monthly fee will also be introduced.
Yeah. Look at that. He invented Spotify.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Good job.
Good for him.
That has been the Back in the Day Machine.
All right. All good cultural context. Glad to know that.
Spotify was a glimmer in Richard Branson's eye. People were making revenge porn, but in a positive way, I guess.
And mostly ignoring the 2004 presidential election.
Yeah.
Well, we also had I can tell you about the 32-page contract for the... for the Bush-Kerry debate. Yeah, thank you.
No, you can't because we got to get into the episode. So this week's Balmer B story I've got a baby now. And so I only have so much time to make these. Thank you for the applause, Vince. So this one is to the tune of a song that I very much enjoy. And I will play it for you right now. And cheese didn't need to kill his dog. Jimmy Hizzy killed his dog. They blew the fire for a dog. Well, bark, bark. All right. There we go. You can listen to the full version of that song. That's right, Mike. There is a full version of that song at the end of the episode. All right. This is a great episode. And I'm very excited to talk to you guys about it because this, for me, is the best Herc and Carve episode that we've had so far. Herc and Carve have been kind of skating along in the show so far with these like kind of like little B story bits that have been like funny. But I
don't know if this beats Fuzzy Dunlop.
To me, this is miles ahead of Fuzzy Dunlop. This is the episode in which Herc and Carve are playing what I would consider a game you play as a middle schooler with your friends, and they're doing it as adults and as policemen.
Well, because they're as emotionally mature as middle schoolers at this point. 100. You know, Carver kind of matures. He gets to at least like being senior in high school, I think.
Yes.
The show, but yes, continue.
It is this is like probably my favorite Herc and Carve episode. And then there's just also tons of like, I don't know. There's tons of moments in this episode where I felt like I had to do some Googling. Like there was like some research that I was doing. I learned about a lot of things. I learned about Gus Triandos. I learned about Mary Tyler Moore saying, "Oh, Rob." It was just, I don't know. This was for me one of my favorites. Vince, what did you think of this episode?
I feel like this episode, it sets up. It sets up all the big plot lines from season three, which with Bunny Colvin trying like his legalization scheme, Marlo taking over the corners, Daniels and Rhonda starting to smash. But before that, it almost feels like, okay, we got these big plot lines that we're about to set up so we can just have some fun. And it feels like one of the most theatrical episodes of The Wire, like where they're treading water and they're like, oh, let's just go for it. And it's one of the silliest episodes. And I feel like it's feels the most like Oz or Deadwood of any Wire episode, like before it gets into the meat of it, like just the way it's shot and you know, just like the open silliness and theatricality of it are, I wouldn't want every Wire episode to be like this, but I enjoy like that this one was.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because even the intense like police work that's going on in the show is usually about a real murder or something real that's taking place. Like, you know, even if it's a one off thing, you know, the stakes are always very high. And then this one is just like, you know, the joke is that she's killed his dog. And that's it.
Wild.
Right. That's what all of this is kind of revolving around. Like all the normal going through the motions, like we're listening to The Wire. Okay. Now we're sending out units. Now we're going to do this. Now we're going to do that. And the whole thing is really premised on a joke. Like there's a punchline at the end of all this that they're waiting for, which, you know, dog fighting is a terrible thing. And we should, we should take note of the fact that it's an awful thing that he did.
I'm against it.
Yeah, I'm against dog fighting.
I think dogs should be friends.
People should not kill their dogs.
You shouldn't do that. Right.
So also, stop docking the damn pit bull's ears. Like, ugh, I hate dock ears.
Yeah, it's all terrible. And so, like, but at the end of the day, it's a funny joke, at least in the context of the show, which is not something we usually get. And then if you couple that, like you were saying, with everything Herc and Carver are going through, like, if you counted up the scenes, like, at least half of this is mostly revolving around funny stuff.
Yeah, which is rare for The Wire, because I feel like one of the biggest impediments to a lot of people enjoying The Wire or like trying to get into it is its kind of novel like nature, the way it's kind of like slowly weaving these stories, slowly building the stories up, and episodes don't really have this like self-contained thing. So early on, you know, if you were going to get jokes, it was going to be just one storyline. And you wouldn't have like a funny episode. It would be a funny moment. This episode, I feel like it does both very well. It builds up the, you know, the reason for the season, which is the eventual
Jesus Christ,
the reason for the season. The eventual creation of Hamsterdam, the you know, the free trade drug zone, while simultaneously showing the major crimes unit fail spectacularly in the funniest fashion possible. In, you know, cheese's
it is like the, it
dog
is,
thing.
It's like it's them living out the ultimate cop dream, which is just that the people you're chasing just randomly lose 40 IQ points overnight and do something really, really stupid. And they're like, well, I don't know why he did it. He just decided to confess one day.
It was
weird.
So amazing. And it's also the scene with the cheese interrogation, I think, is a modern day Who's on First. It's just so funny. And like, credit to Method Man, the acting, like the comedic chops that he has in the scene are so good.
This episode was written and directed by a British guy whose name is Steve Shill, which I don't know, I find funny because me and Matt talk about Shills all the time.
We talk about Shills a lot.
But also, like, I feel like you can sense the Britishness in it in the way that it is clearly like fascinated by like Black American vernacular English. Like, it's very
That's true.
Like, everything is like, oh, they say dog to refer to people now, don't they? That's very strange.
Yeah, I take that. Yeah, for sure.
You hear him say he's talking about Edgar Allan Poe house, but we thought he's talking about the poor house. It's very weird.
That's a good point. It actually is, upon reflection, kind of ridiculous that they confuse dog, D-O-G, with dog, D-A-W-G. But I have the scene that I want to play for you guys.
Please, lose your dog.
You my dog.
I just want to know who's your dog. Dog, who's your dog?
Y'all ain't laying no bodies on me, man. Lawyer time.
Oh, he was my dog, man. I ain't never gonna find another.
Man, y'all some cold ass motherfuckers, man.
What happened, Chief?
I thought he punked me, all right? So I did what I had to do.
Well, what's done is done. But maybe we can help you on this.
How? You gonna bring him back?
Okay. Dog, where's that body?
Where I left it, most likely. Warehouse on the east side.
And he's still there?
As far as I know. Unless the SPCA come around.
What?
Looks like they broke him.
I gotta say, you really showed me something on this.
I mean, to me, like, that scene is perfect, hilarious, and ends with... You think, like, the button is them figuring out that it's a dog, but the button is all of the bosses being, like, surrounding the box and going, like, man, we really knocked it out of the park.
Yeah, we did it. We did it, you guys.
Popping champagne and give each other handshakes, busting out the cigars.
We are such good police.
And also, just like the subtext that, he didn't actually confess to a murder. He just confessed to shooting a pit bull in the face, like in the...
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that's illegal too, no?
Yeah, the crazy thing, I thought that too.
He's going to get... They were going to ring him up for something because that was like a little sort of like a post-aperitif joke, which was like, oh, we got him on illegal discharge of a firearm and cruelty to animals, which...
Right. Yeah, and I mean, you know, and I get the feeling that that's not a felony from that scene where they're just like, oh man, you know, this is fucked. You know, we don't got him for murder. We just have him for shooting a dog to death. And I'm like, well, you could. Got to be
Michael.
Are
Vick,
there not years involved?
Yeah,
with
Michael
that?
Vick went to prison for that.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, maybe Baltimore. I imagine the Baltimore dogfighting laws, at least at that moment.
Yeah, they have a longer history of, animal fights as sport there.
My favorite bit actually from that whole scene, I don't think it wasn't in that clip, when they're pressing him, they're going to try to flip him on Prop Joe. And he's pushing back and he's pushing back. He's like, you know what? Forget it. I don't even know Prop Joe. Like, go away. I do love that little line. Is like him signaling that, like, okay, we're done sort of talking to each other. Like, I'm so done talking to you that I'm not going to pretend not to know Prop Joe. You know what? Forget it. I don't even know Prop Joe.
I don't even know my uncle.
Yeah. I don't know this person who we all know that I know. Okay.
Yeah. Right. No, that is true. It's like, of all the people to say that.
Yeah,
his.
I never heard of no actual, Prop Joe. What the hell are you talking about?
His actual nephew.
Okay.
Not going to be able to sell that one.
Was not sad when Cheese died.
That is like one of the greatest deaths in the show. Where
because I didn't really see that coming when it came.
No, no one did. Yeah. It was. Okay. He's. You know. You're like, oh man, is this going to end with cheese on top?
Yeah. Jesus.
You know, is the cheese really going to stand alone? And
I
then,
love cheese on top. Sorry.
Stupid. Yeah, but it was very cathartic.
It's weird that I remember that death much more vividly than Bodhi's.
That is weird.
Maybe just because it was like such a shocking scene. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's almost a jump scare.
You guys agree that, because it was that, like, they were getting ready to like make this deal. Oh, we're now on a completely different episode, obviously.
No, that's
like,
fine.
Yeah, they were gonna make that deal, and then instead they just shot him in the back of the head, like it was like a Joe Pesci and Goodfellas thing.
Yeah, yeah, it was great.
Really, really great.
Yeah, because like at that point, he was responsible for the death of his uncle. Like he cut a deal with Marlowe, and you were just like, this guy is a total scumbag.
Yeah, which, and, you know, go ahead.
Oh, and mostly he killed the dog. That was like mostly what I was mad about.
Yeah, but Prop Joe is also obviously high also on Prop list of favorite characters of the show, because he's phenomenal.
So good, so good. But you know, I just love dogs. So fucked up, dog. But yeah, no, the whole beginning of every season of The Wire, you know, so far has been, I mean, the first season, it took 5 episodes for them to even get a wire going. And
yeah,
then
at this
in the
point, they've
season,
established the pattern that, like, it's going to take us 3 episodes for the season to be about the thing that the season is about.
Right. But in this one, they get this season starts with a wire already up and running for months, and they're just waiting and waiting.
Right.
To
but
find...
that's not what like the season is about.
Right. Right. And you don't know that up until this point. Yeah. You are like trying to figure out who their target is. You just know that they are failing at this. And then you know that they're, you know, going after Stringer kind of still, and they're going after Cheese. And to watch The Wire be blown in the second episode of the season, right, over a dog is a great joke. It's like a joke by someone who understands what The Wire was doing the 2 previous seasons and going, we're not doing that again. Right. So I particularly love it. Yeah, it's pretty great. And leads to McNulty kind of going off on his own. And he has a small arc in this episode in which he just realizes that he's going to be taking some time out of his own schedule to figure out what happened with D'Angelo. And he solves that murder in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
Well,
actually,
he solves what happened. He doesn't find the culprit.
He establishes that it was a murder, not a suicide.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, because the state cops, and you know, they can't do anything. We know that. And so it's not implausible that McNulty could come in and take a look at some things a second time and not have it just be like some state guy just
like
filling out some paperwork. Cause it was a dead prisoner and like probably who cares. Yeah. They probably spent like
100%
at it all for sure.
Yeah. They don't care. And the only reason that McNulty cares is because he is obsessed with catching Stringer, and the kind of like the game of cat and mouse that they're playing in this season. And, you know, once again, we're going to get to this in another episode, but I love the begrudging respect that McNulty has for Stringer. And later on when he just goes to the copy store and thinks that Stringer has turned his life around to become a photocopy entrepreneur. it's pretty great.
The drug dealing was just about like achieving his dream of being a small copy franchisee.
Yeah, of managing a mom and pop Kinko's.
I mean, listen, everybody celebrates anyone who wants to take on Kinko's, which is
100%
arguably like the worst franchise, worst chain store of any chain, probably.
Famously,
famously,
place that is, it's actually cornered a very interesting market, because I mean nobody really has a high quality home printer or scanner or copy machine.
It's a last resort place on so many levels.
It's where you gotta go, and it's like they almost on purpose are like, you know, it's like the DMV, it's like you have to be here. It's they're like airlines. They can do whatever they want. Let's get into a little bit of what is happening with Marlowe, because this is Marlowe's, not his first episode. We saw him a little bit last episode, but this is his, I think, this is his grand entrance.
I mean, to begin with, he's pondering some spinny rims, which were, remember spinny rims? We don't have spinny rims anymore, do we? They were big for a while there.
I feel like if we did have spinny rims still, you'd see them more on like the kind of like grind set mindset TikTok people. Mm. You know what I'm talking about? Like the Andrew Tate types, the ones who have like crypto and their like whole vibe is I can't count cash in slow motion and here's my Lambo. I never see those guys with the spinny rims. So I assume that they're not out. Mike Duncan, do you have spinny rims?
I do not have spinny rims.
Oh, okay.
No, I have the most generic dad SUV one could possibly imagine, and my younger self berates me for it every day.
Do you have a Subaru? Yeah,
the guy like used to go to Kinko's and like steal copies so that you could make band show flyers and like turn it like a doctored little counter thing. Clearly walking out with 1,000 pieces of paper, it's like 13 cents, sir. Nobody behind the counter cared.
Yeah,
you know? Like, it was good. Everybody was in on stealing from Kinko's.
So. I honestly think it's your societal duty to rob places that don't employ enough employees. Like you know, like the grocery store where they're like, oh, we're gonna automate everything. Like it is your duty to ring up more expensive things as cheaper.
That's
things
true.
To stealing even out from to make it more expensive for them to
These bananas are steak. These bananas are butter. These bananas
No, that is good praxis to steal from any place that has automated their either automated all of their service jobs or just underemploy everyone who works there. It's good praxis. That's why I steal from Whole Foods.
I haven't seen the spinny rims in a while, but I have seen the opposite seems to have become popular, which is the rims
that don't move.
That's the new thing.
Rims that
stay same.
Yeah, yeah. Rims that stay same. They don't spin even with the car. They just, it's like they're on a thing and they
So it looks like you're on slowly. Hoverboard kind of thing.
Yeah, those I've seen.
Rims are cool. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, rims are cool. But Marlo Stanfield, let's get into him. Marlo is running as far as I can tell, he's running a small crew, like corner crew in West Baltimore. And he should be, like all the other corner crews at this point, going along with Stringer's deal, which is like, you keep your corner, but you buy from our package. Mm-hmm. He's not doing it for whatever reason. What I enjoy watching is the mental gymnastics that Stringer is doing in order to make his plan work, because
Stringer's made the classic economics mental gymnastics that you have to do, or you have to like imagine an imaginary world where the hand of the market could function unencumbered.
Yes. Yeah. No, Stringer's Stringer is, I think it's either Stringer or Marlo is the weak link in Stringer's plan. And I don't blame Marlo. I blame Stringer, because Stringer, like, he wants to do his business without corners. Like he wants to do without corners. And because of that, he has less soldiers. Mm-hmm. And without soldiers, he is like, he's fucked if any of the crews don't go with him, because the only way that they can enforce this is through violence. And I feel like the problem with him is that he is viewing himself as a businessman when really he should be viewing himself as a general. I know we've made fun of like Tony Soprano in the past for being like, I'm a general, but like that is closer to the truth. The truth is you need soldiers because they are loyal. And they don't fight for money. They fight for pride.
He's imagining a world that's only carrots with no sticks. But then you can't like show up to a stick fight with a basket of carrots, because you're just going to get hit with the stick.
Yeah. And leave unaccounted for the fact that there will be people who, for their own reasons, like just literally don't want to be under you. Right. They have their own plans and their own ambitions for themselves that don't involve just being a part of some pyramid that you're building, that you can be part of. And they're like, oh yeah, but you can rise up in the ranks of this like Amway operation that I'm trying to set up here. But Marlo doesn't want that. And if you don't account for that, then you're not accounting for the world that you're actually living in.
Yeah, no. And I feel like that is Stringer's whole like I'm a businessman mindset is, leading to his own downfall. But Yeah, let's get a little bit of Marlowe. This is introducing Marlowe Stanfield. I'm sorry, guys.
We love when Matt gets editing toys, don't we?
I'm so sorry.
It's good with the visual, I will say.
I'm guessing from the terrace. And being all cute about the property line.
Brody, what are you doing?
I just wanted to wait and see what you wanted us to do about it. So, what you want us to do?
Get back to work.
Song still slaps.
I'd like to point out that I made that music diegetic.
Yeah. You did some sound editing work, and it did not go unnoticed by me.
Okay.
I will say, I wish you'd have gone whole hog and like filmed yourself doing a related stand-up bit at the beginning where you're like, "Guy, fellas, don't you hate it when another crew is being all cute with the property line?"
Yeah, no, I'm sure that would have been appreciated.
You're trying to sell this your drugs, and this guy's over here dancing on the property line.
Why don't they make the whole property line out of the black box? First, I think, Mike, you were saying something about what Bodie was wearing. And
he's wearing a dangly do-rag.
Yeah, the style of it.
Yeah,
that was my favorite Looney Tunes character was Dangly Do-Rag, but
stupid. No, I realized that the do-rag has never gone out of style. It like started becoming in style around this time, and it just kind of stayed. It's kind of crazy to me. I mean, I don't know that much about fashion, but I do know that I still to this day see do-rags and
But the way that Bodie is particularly styling it at this moment is that did that enter mm-hmm. into the mainstream in a way, yeah?
I don't think so. it's just kind of hanging there. It does seem he forgot the part with the where you tie it up.
He's also, he's proving why it's called a do-rag and not a talk about it rag because he's out there.
Wow. You know, I thought you were going to say a don't rag.
Yeah.
Brent, do we have an ad?
Yeah, we have ads for do-rags. I thought you were just rolling right into it.
Oh, yeah. Let's take a quick commercial break and do some advertisements. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we're back.
Another really stupid thought that occurs to me. Why did they call the company Dude Wipes when Dude Rags was like right there?
Oh, man. It's like one of those bits that I was like, it's too bad I took the commercial break so soon because you could have ended it with that. Moving on.
Now we like a two-parter.
Yeah. So we see Marlowe in the rim shop, and this is the beginning of the rim shop. The guy he's talking to is his his consigliere, and we're gonna see him a lot in there planning out various operations. And from that conversation, he realizes that he has to play this in a very specific way where he's like, he knows that Barksdale has muscle, but he also does not want to buy their package. He doesn't even know what they want is from what I can tell. He just knows that they need to get the fuck away from him.
That it's not what he wants. Whatever it is that they want, it's not what he wants. And it's not what he has in mind for himself. So it doesn't even matter what they're offering because he doesn't want it.
My question, yeah. like, just I feel like doesn't a consigliere usually have to be of a different race? You know, like usually, like Tony, he's going to Hesh, the Jewish guy, for
That's
his
true.
Advice. I think in like The Godfather, isn't
Tom Hagen?
Yeah, Tom Hagen, the Wasp.
Yeah,
like you need. I feel like you need like someone.
Maybe,
of
maybe that guy's originally from East Baltimore, and then
yeah,
be, yeah. the same thing.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it could be. No, because not to get too deep into the lore, but you know, Godfather Vito Corleone's original consigliere was named Abbandando, I think.
Mm.
And so he's Italian. So you're wrong about that. All I right. think you are also specifically thinking of Analyze This and how how Billy Crystal was like his consigliere, but no. Yeah,
I do not have as an encyclopedic knowledge of Analyze This as you do, Matt, so it's not usually like my first
I've thing. Seen both Analyze This and Analyze That.
I know you've never stopped bringing it up,
and I would like to see a third. That's all I'm saying.
Analyze the other.
Analyze This, that, and the other. Analyze and so forth. But yeah, so he decides to not look Bodhi in the eye and just kind of swing a golf club around, which is a nice implied threat. But you know that he's not going to go for whatever they're selling, and we will see more of that later. But let's get into Herc and Carve. First question I have for you, both of you, is... what's your answer to this question? You could sleep with anyone in the world, as many times, as many girls as you want, but you have to sleep with one guy. Who's it going to be?
Tom Hardy. Oh, did I answer that too fast?
That was
Tom Hardy.
Tom yeah, Hardy.
I mean, it's good to have an answer.
I mean, yeah.
I mean, what other answer is there?
Well, I mean, what about?
Then my answer, French footballer Olivier Giroud.
Mm, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Why?
He's a dreamboat.
And, I need to look him up.
Oh, yeah. He's an incredibly handsome man. And also, he's now the leading goal scorer in French national team history, surpassing Thierry Henry, who could probably also get me into bed without too many drinks.
Yeah, there's a lot of soccer guys that could get it, let's be honest.
Yeah, yeah. Soccer mods are good.
Okay, you guys are missing like the key ingredient of this.
I don't think I am.
It is not supposed to be this easy. You're supposed to have so many caveats. Oh, it needs yeah. to be this many women, this many times. You guys have completely skated over that.
Yeah, you don't have to promise me all these like weirdo fantasies. Just like, I'll go to bed with Olivier Giroud.
I'll fuck this guy for free. Oh,
wait, I'm getting something out of this? I thought that was
no,
the
yeah,
the
exactly.
reward.
Well, when I was younger, you know, speaking of like these games that you play, like so like back in the 90s, right, there was a Friends episode that had mm-hmm. the cheat list episode.
Mm-hmm.
Where like you were are you familiar with the
yeah.
cheat list?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh,
okay,
yeah.
Great. I don't know how much I guess Friends had a huge revival that I never really paid attention to. But so we had a cheat list, but then me and my friends also had a switch list, and you had to actually have five names of the guy of the, basically like if you were a guy and you were straight, it had to be guys. And if you were a woman and you were straight, it had to be women. Just, and like, if you were gay, it had to be women.
Right.
So just like, so I've always, from the time that I was a teenager, kind of like known who was on my switch list at any given time. So
right.
when this comes up, I'm like, yeah, shit, I got five, you know, mostly the French national football team players. Mbappe for sure.
I think the interesting part about this is that Herc, like, he's doing all this to have sex with the Olsen twins, and it's got to be there.
I
was like maybe like a 2 year period when that wasn't weird, because like they went from like, ooh, they're going to turn 18 soon. And there was like a weird, creepy, like thing
right.
around that.
Very
and then it was like maybe 9 months where they like turned into their current form, which is just sort of like a collection of scarves smoking a cigarette.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. There was not much of a period in between that when it was, here's the thing, being sexually attracted to the Olsen twins for me has always been a very strange thing to admit publicly. Not just because, you know, there are these little girls that, you know, we all grew up with, but also because, again, and I've said this many times on this show, the twins' obsession. I don't like it. It's gross. It's low-key incestuous. I don't know what you want them. Why together? I don't know what you want to do with them.
I think it's the basic math of one you woman might be good, over, you might be two women better.
Quite a bit.
I think everyone's underthinking it, Maya.
Yeah, okay. That's true. It's fair.
They are related, and that is not... That's not right for multiple reasons, but I don't like it. And so Herc being into the Olsen twins and admiring their body of work, it fits with his character because he does feel like a scumbag.
He is that kind of simple scumbag. It's true. Yeah. He's the kind of guy who like knew exactly how old they were when they were 17 years old.
Right. Yeah. He's the guy who had the countdown clock to when they turn 18.
Yeah.
And he's like the fast forward 7 years. He's the reason Pornhub has all those step sibling categories.
Honestly, I blame Herc as well. I don't know. It's another thing. I don't need that. It's a little more forgivable than twins. But who would
you've really not answered this question yet.
I don't have my answer ready yet, but I mean, it'd have to be, I think it'd be Pete Davidson.
Okay.
Because I just have to know. I have to know.
Sure.
What, because how? You know what I mean? How? How is it? And the trade-off is that.
He's a charismatic guy.
I get to sleep with every woman that he slept with, and in return, I sleep with him. That's how it works. Yeah. So, you know.
I think he's funny, right?
Yeah.
So and that's always place. And I think, you know, he's got the BDE for a reason, probably.
Yeah, I think he definitely is.
I mean, I
he's
got to
have like three dicks, because how is it possible? I think he has multiples, and we just don't know.
I think it's very simple. Like, I interviewed him like before, like all the Kim Kardashian stuff, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago. And I sort of came away thinking like, oh man, he gave me such great quotes that he probably didn't give to anyone else. Like, he gave me that, like, ooh, I feel special because he gave me all these good quotes.
Okay.
And I feel like that's like just a very basic quality that people, you know, that people prize.
Yeah. No, you could be right. But I think there's something going on there.
Making them feel like you're the only person in the world.
Yeah, I'm special. He talked to me like I'm special. Yeah,
Bill Clinton has that too.
Oh, 100%.
That's what everybody always says about Bill Clinton, which, you know.
Yeah.
We know where he is on that's, the scumbag scale.
100%. And that's the thing is, I think, you know, you need to take a little bad with the good in terms of Pete Davidson. I'm sure he is an egomaniac, but I would want to know what that dick do. So we've all answered the question, but let's see what Herc and Carve have to say about it.
One act, one time. Right, and the minute I name a guy, you're going to be like, I knew you were a cocksucker from the first time I laid eyes on you. Steve McQueen, huh? That's your fantasy? You fucking closet case motherfucker.
Steve McQueen?
Fuck you. It's a setup. Both Olsen twins. Ashley. Kate. Mary Kate. And yeah, I mind their body of work. They're yours. All you gotta do is name a guy. I'm not catching, I'm pitching. No problem.
So, what I find interesting about this whole sequence is that Herc knows it's a setup from the jump. He knows this game. And I think everyone does. When you're a kid, you play this game with your friends. And it doesn't matter how many, like, you know, women you put at the top of the list. As soon as you name a guy, you're completely fucked. Everyone's going to make fun of you. And, you know, hopefully nowadays people are a little bit less openly homophobic on the schoolyard, but I have a feeling that that's
this kind of feels
the case.
Like it comes from like the Entourage school of script writing. Like this is kind of how Entourage characters talk to each other. We're like, oh, that's weird. Like, stop being weird. And I'm right. And I've always been like, you had weird friends that that I don't know. Like you couldn't actually get any sort of vulnerability with.
Oh
or
God,
like,
yes,
yeah.
Like, I feel
I
like
mean
real-
the weird. The weird thing about this, like looking back on it, is like the mental gymnastics that they have to go through to like set it up for him to walk into this quote unquote trap.
Yeah.
That right.
Has now been set for him.
I mean, it has a good
Olivier
payoff.
Giroux, if you're out there, like I'm not looking for anything in return here. Just a, yeah.
I like the payoff.
Just a little friendship. Like a nice, like I assume he's going to buy me a nice dinner.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the payoff. And Matt, I think you have some trivia about how, where this goes yes. and how we got there.
So, yeah, I have, so let's get his answer as to who he would choose.
Triandos. Who's Gus Triandos?
He's a catcher with the Orioles back in the day. I mean, my brother had his card. Sorry looking motherfucker, man. I mean, he looked like this little kid who got left at a bus station by his parents.
And I found the card. That is the exact card that he is talking about. And he does look sad.
That was what peak performance looked like in the 50s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That. I mean, that is a man's man.
Chain smoking like a true athlete does. You know, looks like 70 at the age of 30.
Right. Exactly. That is a 23-year-old man.
Yeah, exactly. 23-year-old man. There he is.
Probably spends a lot of time.
Looks like he's been through four wars.
Yeah.
I think it's hilarious that he chose a catcher because he specifically said, I'm pitching, not catching. So he really wanted to make that clear by choosing a catcher. But he chose a very obscure baseball player. And apparently after Gus Triandos died, David Simon wrote a little story about this particular choice on his website, davidsimon.com. And Vince, I have that for you.
Oh, you want me to read that? Okay.
Oh, yeah, if you want.
The tale, this is written by David Simon, so
yeah.
And you can tell. The tale begins with Richard Price, the noted novelist and screenwriter who was kind enough to grace The Wire with some of his script work for four seasons of the HBO drama. Price is famed for the verisimilitude of his urban patois and his detailed characterization, but he doesn't get enough credit, in my opinion, for his comedic chops. Looking to bring in a little of that in a particular episode, we decided to lay a secondary storyline on him in which Herc and Carver engage in that essential debate of fractured masculinity. You can screw any three women in the world if you have sex with a man of your own choosing first. When the script came in, Price had gone us one further, offering up comedy gold. Not only had he accessed the essential lust and homophobia of our characters, but he had combined it with yet another straight male elemental, sports trivia. Price had gone deep into his 1950s-era baseball card collection and picked out the slow, lumbering Baltimore Oriole catcher of the late 1950s. He was well enough known, in Baltimore at least, that the reference would knock Orioles fans on their asses with laughter, but not so well known that the humor inherent in the obscurity of Herc's choice wouldn't play. And more, Herc catching a blowjob from Gus Triandos is a funny thought. The choice itself implies a wonderful overthinking of the problem. After the script was circulated and the entire writing staff gathered itself from the bout of collective laughter, I was suddenly filled with a sharp pang of guilty horror. Was Triando still alive? Why not? He'd only be in his early 70s, I calculated. Christ. I mean, I know the guy is, legally, some sort of public figure as an ex-professional ball player, but how do you throw this joke up on national television without his say-so? Do what? Price asked. We have a number for Triandos. He lives out in California. You're going to call him? What choice do I have? Oh, shit. Never mind. I'll think of something else. No, Triandos is perfect for this. Inspired, even. But Richard, when you speak of me in the days to come, remember what I did for you here and speak well.
I like that he was like, never mind. If you're going to call him and tell him about it, we'll just choose a different
natural
guy.
Reaction, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is hard to describe how fast I was speaking when I got on the phone with Gus Triandos. Trying desperately to turn the corner with the old fella, to make him see that the joke wasn't really on him, but on this character named Herc, this big, lumbering narcotics cop in Baltimore. No, no, he wasn't saying that you had sex with him. No, no way. And he's not even saying that you would want to have sex with him. It's not about you, really, trust me. I'm not sure I understand, Triandos said. Okay, let me send you the pages. I'm going to send all the pages for this storyline, and if you see what the joke is and you are okay with it, then great. And if not, we won't use your name. Just look at the pages, okay? This is a television show? Really? Christ. I sent the pages off with little hope, other than that Gus Triando said he would get together with his sons and they would read them and he would eventually get
this
back
to me. This is
phenomenal.
Yeah.
Naturally, I imagined he would pick Oh, yeah, I know. Who naturally, I imagine he would pick up the phone to call me and everyone with anything to do with this television show a pack of free-range assholes. But 4 days later, my cell phone rang and Triandos was on the line. I get it. It's pretty funny. You get it? Yeah, he feels sorry for me because I had to catch Wilhelm. Exactly. Hey, I feel sorry for me. Catching Wilhelm was miserable, he laughed. Go ahead. It's not like you're making me out to be gay or nothing. It's just a joke. I never had a chance to speak to Mr. Triandos after that, to hear how that episode actually landed on him, but I like to imagine him enjoying the joke and the improbable cultural reference for years to come.
Incredible.
So I have a theory like about this whole story, which is, again, a fantastic story.
Yeah,
great story. Like, I feel like the ultimate writer thing is like picking, like there's no more writer way of remembering some guys than remembering a knuckleballer. Like, writers are all obsessed with knuckleballers. Tin Cup, the entire origin story for Tin Cup's nickname is that he was a catcher for a knuckleballer. If you've ever read,
I was briefly in a band called the R.A. Dickies.
There you go.
Yeah.
I don't know who that is. I assume he's a knuckleballer.
He's a knuckleballer.
Yeah, there you go. One of the greatest baseball books ever written is called Ball Four. It's by Jim Boughton, who was like a 60s pitcher who sort of had a whole second act to his career by learning how to throw a knuckleball. He's also the guy who invented Big League Chew with along with the director of Tar somehow.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, I feel like
other thing.
The ultimate let's remember a guy is let's remember a knuckleballer.
Well, yeah. I love that probably the reason why Triandos ultimately decided that this was fine is that whoever wrote it was it wasn't just like they pulled a name out of a hat, right? This is clearly somebody who knows enough about baseball that they can intelligently put in a line about him being a catcher who suffered while catching White Wilhelm, which was 100% true. It wasn't just we're writers and we need a baseball player to fit into this thing. It was, you know, he read it and understood that it was coming from somebody who knew his career and appreciated his career, and so he was cool with it.
Yeah, I appreciated his sacrifice.
It's about being desirable also, right?
Yeah, sure.
You're ultimately saying you're a desirable person.
Yeah, I also, of all the men in the world,
yeah,
you know, Herc chose him.
Yeah, I also think...
Congratulations.
Congrats, Gus.
You got this big wad of narcotics officer who's just really...
Who will allow you to go down on him.
Yeah, so he can get with the Olsen twins.
Because
he feels sorry for you, yeah.
I feel like this is... just perfect for the way writers always write sports, which is like every sports movie, like the screenwriter imagines the way to be good at sports is just like finding the right metaphor. Like as soon as the coach figures out how to like imbue his players with like the correct metaphor to think of, like that's how they become. Like, so the knuckleballer is like the ultimate writer's fantasy of an athlete because it's like the ultimate example of a guy who's succeeding not through like sheer athletic ability or you know, fast twitch muscles. It's like, oh, he's doing it through being clever and being sneaky and having a lot of
think that's ultimately where all of this comes down to, is that a knuckleballer isn't really an athlete in the way that we think of an athlete as an athlete. Like, we all imagine that if things had gone a little bit differently, like, we could succeed as knuckleballers.
Yeah, if only I was clever enough.
Yeah, or if I could just grip it just right, then I too could be a major league player, because I can't do anything else on a baseball field at even a high school level. But
But standing there throwing a knuckleball,
yeah,
I could do that.
Yeah, how hard could it
really
be?
Really slow that doesn't move. It's
you'd have
difficult.
To also be good at the throwing the other ones, which would be my biggest issue.
No, I mean, the Necros of the world, like they were almost exclusively knuckleballs. You know, you didn't even have to slip a fastball in that often because the pitch itself was so...
Yeah, it's so its own changeup.
Yeah.
I did one time go to YouTube to see if I could find a compilation of the slowest pitches ever. And it was a lot of fun to watch. Ever seen a pitcher throw 50 miles an hour? It's great.
Wakefield... didn't even like take a windup. He kind of just like stood there and just tossed it in there.
Yeah, and not counting this new thing of position players pitching all the time who just kind of lob it up there, but actual pitchers throwing lob balls. It's great fun because we can all imagine ourselves doing it.
Yeah, it's the character in the Marvel movie who's is like supposed to be the surrogate for the audience. That's me. I could do that. The knuckleballer is the everyman of the baseball world.
100%. Yep.
But yeah, Herc, of course, decides Gus Triandos, and
great answer.
But unfortunately, he pays for it.
Four big guys, and they bust on my eyes. They eat my ass just like apple pie.
If they there we go. Sorry, listen. If I make the clip, I'm gonna play it. That's time is taken out of my day.
Yeah, they're not the most enlightened bunch of dudes I've ever come across in my life.
No. Which is why they're great as cops. And we all enjoy that.
Yeah.
But yeah, Herc and Carve also have a great scene with Poot and Bodhi, in which they run into them at the movie theater.
Oh, yeah.
And to me, that was like, have you guys ever run into your teacher in public outside of school? Do you guys remember that feeling of seeing a teacher IRL and being like, oh, shit.
You have a life? Gross.
You go to the movies? I remember the weirdest thing was like seeing them with like a significant other because, I mean, I don't know what the teachers you had, but LAUSD teachers, they're not the most attractive bunch. You know, and so all I could think about was like, Mr. Bailey fucks. I don't like that. I don't like that one bit.
But didn't like thinking about Herc fucking anybody.
Oh God, I think we all are against that. Yeah. It's a very disgusting thought. But yeah, I enjoyed that, especially since like in a way it mirrors that kind of like universal, you know, oh, I ran into my teacher at the, you know, fucking hobby shop or whatever, because it's not a teacher. It's a guy who literally abuses you physically every day.
It's like running into the vice principal specifically, like of all of the kind of like people from our childhoods, right? The person who's in charge of like discipline, who's just mean and getting in. You're like, you go to the first wives club? Like, why do you? That's man, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah, the idea that like, you know, these people would ever be off the clock from, you know, kicking the ass of a child standing on a corner selling drugs is, you know, it's probably strange to them. And of course, the other way around, too. You know, they're like, you know, weird that these drug dealers are off the clock right now. But yeah, that was a lot of fun. But to get into some of what's going on with Bunny and what we're setting up here, one of the greatest moments, I think, in the scene in terms of like not played for laughs, but just played for just good acting is the Bunny Colvin paper bag speech. I thought that was like a brilliant analogy. And also there's something about this whole Hamsterdam idea that I'm like, you know, we should do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we kind of are.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in different aspects, I mean, definitely there is, living in San Francisco, there were certain areas of the Tenderloin that I was like, okay, this is Hamsterdam. This is kind of like the free trade zone. The cops don't really bother people as long as they keep it in this area.
Yeah, Seattle and Portland both kind of have that Amsterdam vibe going right now.
Yeah. And but I think what is sort of the, I mean, the incredible thing about it is whereas the paper bag is something that to this day is still kind of, it's still considered a good civic compromise. People still will put a paper bag around it, especially, you know, in the hood, you put a paper bag around your alcoholic beverage. No one's going to really bother you for it. With drugs, we just still as a society are not there yet. They will find any reason to take any of these, like, you know, free selling, free using zones and bust them up in order to get some good stats out of it, which is very sad. But Yeah, I have a clip of that.
In 50s and 60s, there was a small moment of goddamn genius by some nameless smoke hound who comes out to cut rate one day, and on his way to the corner, he slips that just bought pint of elderberry into a paper bag. A great moment of civic compromise. That small, wrinkled-ass paper bag allowed the corner boys to have their drink in peace, and it gave us permission to go and do police work. There's never been a paper bag for drugs. Until now.
He doesn't really address how you're going to cover a crack pipe with a paper bag and still be able to smoke and light it.
It's a metaphor.
I think it's a metaphor, bro.
I think it's a metaphor.
You know how
in with art, and sometimes I have to explain art to Vince. Sometimes art, you say things.
Yes, go on.
Wouldn't the bag light on fire? Yeah, so it's not actually how it would be, but it's like you say things and you say, oh, but it's similar.
Yeah.
Did I explain art good just then?
Oh, like yeah,
there's
similar?
It might be a simile, right?
But okay.
Yeah. So it's, it's art. They're doing an art. But I am very excited for this coming season because the Hamsterdam arc is, I think, one of the most brilliant arcs in the whole series because it kind of shows that kind of experiment that you do see, in big cities, especially across the country. And you see its entire life cycle. And it gets into the reason why at the end of the day, it doesn't work. And who is fighting the war on drugs? Like, why do we keep doing this over and over? Why are we all Herc? Knowing we're in a trap, knowing no matter what we do, we can pick Gus Triandos, we can pick every Olsen twin and Olsen sibling, and we're still going to end up in the same place. Like, how do we break that cycle? And Bunny decides he's not going to play that game. He's not going to fuck Gus Triandos. He's not going to suck off Taylor Hansen to fuck all the Spice Girls.
In terms of like bringing context, like the context into this, like this is coming out in 2004. Like this is before it was really even like appropriate to be like people shouldn't be busted for weed anymore, mm-hmm. right? Where, like that was the conversation that was still being had at the time, where it was like third rail politics to be like, I don't think that we should have people in jail just because they have like an eighth of weed on them. And so for all of us who were growing up, who just wanted to like get high, you sort of have this like libertarian mentality about drug use.
Totally.
Because it includes all the drugs of your choice as well. But this is being dropped into a society that can't even get over pot yet.
Right.
And so we're coming up on, we're 20 years beyond. We've already done the 20th anniversary, right, of The Wire debuting for sure. We're 20 years on from that. And yeah, we've sort of cleared weed off the deck. But there are still, until we start treating drugs and drug addiction like the social problem that it is and not the mm-hmm. law enforcement criminal thing that it is, then yeah, we're never going to break this. And you can't just do what this is, which we're seeing happen on the West Coast, was let's just kind of legalize drug use but not have any of the other sort of support right. services that are necessary
yeah.
to like
right.
have people maybe temporarily cycle through this but then get out of it, and instead just creating these like permanent communities where people are mm-hmm. doing horrible things to themselves and to other people.
Yeah, right. If you don't have the resources to treat the addiction, like all of the other stuff is kind of, it's just like a matter of politeness or not, you know.
And it's also short-sighted because it just creates a new cycle within this like broken framework where it's like, okay, this is going to last for a little bit until this area becomes an eyesore for the the new gentrifiers and the new developments that are going to go around, and then there's going to be a political outcry, and then there's going to be a tough on crime mayor who's elected, and so on and so forth. And it just, you know, it's showing that the war on drugs oftentimes is perpetuated by people's campaign managers, essentially. I mean, this whole this whole Hamsterdam idea is born out of season is born out of the fact that the mayor picks an arbitrary number of murders that need to go down. And Bunny Colvin is like, how the fuck do you make a murder go away? He decides to do Hamsterdam because it will create less violence in his district. And it's like, the only reason that the mayor wants this is because Carchetti is getting on his ass about crime because he has ambitions. So it's like, how much of the war on drugs is driven by the ambitions of politicians? And it's a good amount.
Yeah. And then they're going to realize that, like, oh, I guess the citizenry would rather have invisible murders than like a giant eyesore of like a drug free zone. And they
if you listen to certain elements in San Francisco, it definitely seems like they would much rather have more invisible murders and less visible petty crime.
It's what suburbia chooses every time, like 9 times out of 10. I mean, because it's two shitty choices. Like, you're not giving anyone a good choice,
right? Yeah. And it's funny, like, watching it in San Francisco, because it is like the most like purported, like, we are the most liberal city in the world. And watching these guys turn into like techno fascists and like basically turn into, screaming suburban housewives of the 50s, you know, they're all just, and they're doing it with a kind of a liberal tinge, you know, and you're just like, what you're saying is you don't want to see any of these people. You don't care if they get help. You don't care about anything. You just don't want them in your line of sight. And they're very liberal. And also them kicking out, like recalling Chesa Boudin was like one of those moments where I was just like, okay, San Francisco is officially done. It is just, there's no hope for it anymore, because it was, I had some hope when we got, Chesa Boudin, but then, it all went to shit, didn't it?
Because it's full of techno fascists who would rather of these, you know, gross people just go away. Why can't we just put the gross people somewhere else? Why can't they go and help them more?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Be like that here in San Francisco.
Yeah. And, you know, you talk about like kind of how we are, you know, 20 years on, at least we're, you know, legalizing weed, and it's like, but it's still federally.
Well, you're also like, you're trying to make, they're trying to make it like the liberal position is to just like not notice homelessness as a problem. Right. It's like, oh no, this is fine. Actually, I like
I like
walking past tent cities, and it's like, well, no, you actually need some.
No, that's the thing, is because you can't do any of these things.
You can't
in
change
isolation,
anything structurally.
Right?
You
have to do the whole thing.
Yeah.
Right.
And address these social questions.
So we are in the HERC framework. We are still in this framework where we have not decided to abandon it completely. We are still in this trap where we are like, one side is like, oh, I'm going to pick all of these women and they're going to be so hot. All of the Spice Girls, every single girl group from the 90s. And, you know, then you have to, I'm going to take everything back to Herc fucking Gus Triandos, and you guys just have to accept that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like the framework in and of itself is fucked. And because there isn't really, outside of, you know, the internet, a real push to just legalize drugs, blanket legalization, the only place you can land is, I don't want to see homeless people, kick them all out, or, oh no, I love homeless people, seeing them is fine. And it's like, and housing them, you know, and just, it's like all of these things that we do except for legalized drugs. And, that's why the show is timeless, I think, you know, because it's like timeless in the saddest possible way.
Certainly when I watched The Wire, I was not like, wow, this sure is of a time, you know, like, wow, what a, yeah. what a time capsule to like another place.
Yeah.
Yes. Whereas like, if I was to watch, say like, you know, I haven't watched it in a while now, but like, you know, I watched some West Wing couple years ago,
yes.
and that is just like, this is a time capsule. Of
yes.
Yeah. We're like four epochs beyond yeah. like where this show was when it was coming out.
Yes.
But yeah, no, you don't get the feeling about The Wire that like, what was gosh, I don't understand this. The past yeah. is a foreign country, you know, like it's none of that is happening with The Wire.
What was the Sorkin show, like Newsnight or whatever? Or
Newsroom.
Newsroom. Like that yeah. was a time capsule when it was released. Like it was.
Yeah. It immediately dated itself. Like
yeah.
right out the shoot. But I do think that The Wire will ultimately be timeless, even if like in 100 years, maybe in 100 years or 200 years we'll get there, but it's, you know, larger critiques of, you know, governing structures and the incentives of politics, mm-hmm. and, you know, how, you know, the cops and the gangs are basically just the same thing, except one of them has a badge and the others don't, like all of that stuff. I think a lot of like what is in this show would be recognizable like to Romans. You know, if we brought some Romans forward and said, you know, watch some shows, they'd be like, yeah, we basically get this one. You know, there's yeah. there's some guys that are trying to make money doing things that are forbidden by the officials, and they're officials who are corrupt. Like all of this is recognizable yeah. human behavior. Unlike West Wing, which does not really resemble normal human behavior like at all.
If any show was written by a liberal AI bot, it is
it's just pure fantasy land stuff.
It's so great.
Is really not.
Did they do 9/11? Did that happen in the West Wing?
The West Wing didn't do. I meant like who did that? Like Aaron Sorkin didn't do 9/11.
It was
Bush and Cheney. That yeah. No, they did actually the first sort of chip on West Wing's reputation was right after 9/11. They did an episode called, I think, Isaac and Ishmael. That nobody ever wants to talk about ever again. It was like a one-off thing where they had to go into the basement of the White House because there was like a terror threat, but they never, uh-huh. they never explicitly called it 9/11, right? They never actually covered 9/11, but they like go into a basement and it's like, it was the most like sort of like cringy, noxious, like debate about political. It was so painful to watch.
Their 9/11 episode is them hiding out.
Yeah, yeah, in the basement. Because
Did
they
you
had
see-
to go down there, and they were like, there was it was like a student group. So he was like leading this discussion with the students on like, why do Muslims hate Jews? And you're just like,
oh god, this is
painful to watch. And it was at the time. I was absolutely panned at the time for being totally tone deaf.
Did you see the Newsroom episode? I think they're on the plane and they're finding out that
sharks jumping each other at the same yeah, time.
I feel like I think it was like when they found out that Osama bin Laden had been killed. And everybody's fighting on the plane, and then the pilot comes out and there's like a close up on his pilot's badge, and everybody calms down because like that is Aaron Sorkin's central ideology is that he's a uniform
misogyny.
Well, that too, and he's just a uniform worshiper. We've said on our podcast before that in the rough draft of every Aaron Sorkin script, the woman is just named my ex-wife.
Yeah.
I mean, because that whole scene is about how this flight attendant is right, but and every one of the main characters is wrong and acting in a totally reprehensible way. And then it's not until the captive dad comes out, and then it's like, oh well, hysterical mom, why don't you go off to one side, and I will accept the
stop being a woman.
Congratulations! Yeah. You know, I wanted to be the first to tell you we got him for you. Yeah, that shit's just
they all salute.
We heroically
or some
murked
shit.
A guy in his porn dungeon.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a clip of that scene. Hold on.
Four big guys, and they bust on my eyes. They eat my ass just like apple pie. Oh, if they keep fucking me like this, I might just die. They pipe my booty till I cry. He licked my dick in the cum.
That guy gets shot like 2 minutes later. So
that's true. He does.
Hopefully, he learned a lesson there that he should stop being so homophobic, and he should think about who he would sleep with.
Yeah,
you know, because actually, he's got an answer too. And maybe if we all start thinking about who we're not immediately sexually attracted to, we would be willing to have sex with, that we could maybe then figure out the drug problem.
Yeah, someone really did bust on his eyes.
We got to think holistically here.
I completely agree. I like that we played the game very progressively, where we just went with, here's the guy, and I don't need any of the girls. Ally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm an open-minded dude who's hot for various French footballers.
100%. And Tom Hardy, I completely agree.
Sure.
Tom Hardy is just like, there's something, I feel like I would fuck him just to like hang out with him and talk to him about stuff, because I feel like he has a really like nice voice. Like, you know, I just feel like we would, you know, he could just read to me. Well, that's the episode. is there anything that I missed? A favorite scene, a least favorite scene, or something else you guys want to talk about? Vince?
I love the scene where Bunk and McNulty are in the bar, and they have
they run
series,
a play.
They run a play, and the play is to purposely gross out a woman so that your friend can come in and be the lesser of two evils. And I'm like, that's, you know, not bad. I like what he did there.
Yeah. Very few redeeming characters on this show.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There's, again, no good guys. It's just a lot of gray.
Least favorite. Sorry, are we doing both at the same time?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
Least favorite, I could have done without the Poe house. Like, that feels very like a white dude fascinated by black English wrote that scene.
Yeah.
I mean,
for sure.
And like, if they were going to do it, they like fully explained the joke. Like, he said it twice. Like, we kind of got it the first time. And then, anyway.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what was interesting I thought about that was that it is funny that white people would go into the hood in Baltimore looking for Edgar Allan Poe's house and just assume that anyone that you ask on the street would be like, oh yeah, I am familiar with Edgar Allan Poe's house. Let me just give you a grand tour. Like, it is a very funny thing to ask a stranger on the street. Mike, did you have a favorite scene, a least favorite scene, or something else that we missed?
Oh, well, I mean, I hit plus 15 on the dogfighting, cause I don't need that in my life. Right. I just kind of skipped through that.
Yeah.
I don't actually need that shown to me. So I would say that's what was my least favorite part, but the best part of this is Bunny, you know, coming out and sort of announcing watching the show again. You know, this is literally the only episode I've rewatched, is, you know, I didn't know exactly at the time what this season was going to turn into. And so knowing now what is coming, like that little moment of like, this is setting up what's probably your favorite season of The Wire, because it's the most sort of like crazily ambitious, because there's no crazy ambition like a guy who's, you know, 3 months from retirement and they can't do anything about what he's about to do. Like, that's when crazy ambition gets fun, and he's about to do something really, you know, he's taking a big swing here, and I love it.
Yeah. I love a good big swing, and I love Robert Wisdom. Just another guy who, there's like a, you know, there's some guys who I just like, they go on a list of like, daddy hold me, and he's just one of those guys who, like, if he just held me, I would feel safe in his arms. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's going to wind up doing that. He saves the one of them, right? I think the only one who ever got out is because of Cole.
That's right. Yeah. You know, maybe I'm right about that. Maybe I should hit up Robert Wisdom, see if he'll save me. If I had to give this episode a letter grade, and I do, I'd give it a B+. Vince, what would you give this episode if you had to give it a
letter? Yeah, very tough choice. I mean, I think I am going to give this an honest, solid B+ this time.
Oh.
Yeah.
Mm. It's, okay.
Like I said, it's a silly episode, and I wouldn't want every episode to be like this, but, you know, this one I enjoyed.
Yeah. All right. Mike Duncan, what would you give this episode if you had to give it a letter grade?
I think I would give it, it's not quite an A, and it's not as bad. It's not a B, so I would say B+ as well.
Okay, B+. All right. Big shocker here on Pod Yourself The Wire. That is a solid B+ episode of The Wire and a solid A+ episode of Pod Yourself The Wire. Mike Duncan, thank you so much for coming on and talking about The Wire with us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Where can people find you?
It's getting a little dicey out there on social media, because I used to be able to say, like, you can find me on Twitter, but like, I'm not really on Twitter anymore because that thing got blown all to hell. So I did get the coveted Blue Sky invite.
Nice.
So I'm on Blue Sky or Blue Ski, where a bunch of people who are used to saying things and having people respond to them are just saying things and having nobody respond to them because nobody's there. And so everybody's really frustrated because they're like, nobody likes the things that used to generate all this engagement and like dopamine hits for my brain, but nobody's getting those in there anymore. So it's a bunch of like true posters going slowly insane because there's no audience.
Yes.
Which is fun. So I am on that.
I love it.
But I am about to start my third podcast, which will be a show about history and history books mostly. Like it'll be like 80-85% history books with a woman named Alexis Coe, who is a presidential biographer herself. And we've been friends for a while and decided to start up the show, which will be called the Duncan & Coe History Show, which you'll be able to find wherever you find this podcast, whenever it is that we actually get it out the door, which will be in the next few months.
So do you guys do a new book every episode, or do you go into? Okay.
No, I think it'll be a weekly show. It'll come out on Tuesdays, which is pub day in the industry. So hopefully once we sort of build it up a little bit, if you've got a new history book coming out on this Tuesday on pub day, we would be the place that you would come to and talk about your book and have your book get sort of, chatted about and blasted out to all the people that we can drag in. And we're going to try to combine our whatever clout we have, to hopefully like new authors, you know, people that might not otherwise get any kind of visibility at all to give them a bigger profile and kind of get them out the door. Cause both Alexis and I have written books and we know how hard it is to make it out there and promote them.
Yeah.
And get anybody to notice what's going on. So that's the idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm very much looking forward to it. At this point, I've listened to Revolutions so many times that I'm like, I need some new Mike Duncan content. So I'm very excited for your new show.
New Mike, and it's all just conversational. You know, it'll just be like this. There's no, I'm done scripting podcast episodes for a little while.
Oh, good for you. That sounds like hell.
Break. Yeah.
See, this is what an unscripted podcast looks like. It's mostly just talking about what guy you'd fuck.
Hopefully that'll come up on the show.
I hope it does. Mike Duncan, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks a lot.
Patreon.com/Fraudcast. The $8 tier gets you a shout out. Vince, we have very many shout outs this week.
Let's do it.
Yeah, we're just catching up. All right. So the first is Adam Molson.
Molson, what is this guy? A Canadian beer? I'm going to call him Labatt.
Okay, Labatt. Mm-hmm. I like it. I get it. Next is it's Siad or Saeed Sulejmanpaşic. Fuck, bro.
Saeed, Saeed Fred. I'm gonna call this guy Too Sexy.
Too Sexy, yeah, there we go. It could be also Sied, but right, Sied Fred also works, so so Too Sexy works no matter what. Next, Rusty Shackleford.
Yeah, we call this guy Trombone.
Yeah, that works. Then we have Ivan Pugachev.
Pugachev. We call this guy Puka Shells.
Love it. Mm-hmm. Next is David Cass.
Didn't we already give this guy a nickname?
He probably, if I did it again, it means that he re-upped again for another eight.
David Cass, Mama Cass, Ham Sam. I'm going to call this guy Hamsterdam.
Oh, I thought you were going to go Ham Sandwich. You went Hamsterdam. Mm-hmm. I'm very impressed. No,
I'm fitting it in.
You're doing great. Three more left. We have just Kristen. I wasn't able to find a last name, but Kristen, You know who you are?
Hey, I'm Kristen here. Jeez. Ooh, what do we do with just Kristen? So we're going to call her Special K.
Special K. I love it. Now we have Mike Van Herk.
Van Herk. He's herking in a van. Maybe we just call him Triando.
I love it. Triando. He's herking a van. And finally, Jacob Sawyer.
He's like today's Tom Sawyer. We're going to call this guy Rush.
Okay.
Yeah.
All great names. And I hope everyone who got one enjoyed it. Vince, you're so good at this.
Oof, thank you for saying. I mean, they feel pretty tossed off, but, you know, that's kind of my style.
I don't think so at all. I think people love their names. And you can get your own at patreon.com/frogcast, where you can also get bonus episodes of the show. Well, you can get the Frogcast, which is me and Vince just talking about stuff with a guest. It's, you know, it's a lot of fun. And we need you to join. So please join. It's great. And also, we have a bunch of more names to read off, but, you know, from the In Between the Seasons thing. So if you haven't heard your name, it's probably coming up. So just don't yell at me. Frogcast@gmail.com for all your questions, comments, and concerns. Vince, what is the Google Voice number?
415-275-0030.
All right, everyone. Thanks again so much for listening. And until next time, if you come at the king, you best not, man.
Season 3 of The Wire.
So stupid.
Carve makes Herc say something queer. Bodhi and Marlo talk face to face.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.